Thanks.
How you doing, Scott?
Good to see you. Good to see you.
So are you totally exhausted from all of the keynote-y type stuff?
No, it's actually been going, it's, you know, on still the adrenaline high, so.
That's awesome. So when you revealed that only 15% of the people had washed their hands, were you surprised?
No, I guess that's statistically accurate, but it was interesting data.
So let's start out with some of the key things in the keynote that you want to point out, just to start out. What were some of the exciting things for you?
Well, you know, I think it was sort of an exciting day for people that haven't had a chance to see the keynote in terms of just the amount of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the, one of the things that comes across, hopefully, as you watch all the demos, and it was about 85% demos, is just really the comprehensiveness of what we're doing now and the great story for developers in terms of the technology, whether it's for mobile, whether it's for cloud, whether it's around team development. And then, you know, I think also the openness really seeps through, whether it's .NET on Linux, whether it's around supporting .NET on VS Code on a Mac, whether it's having TypeScript and Node support on VS Code on a Mac or inside Visual Studio, whether it's around, you know, open sourcing the Visual Studio Code development tool. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a Google engineer on stage joining us as part of the keynote. And, you know, seeing Hockey app and mobile crash analytics and iOS and Android development. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's a fun time to be a developer right now because there's so much technology. And, you know, I think one of the things that we've really focused on across all of our developer offerings is how do we both open up our developer offerings to be available and usable for anyone using any technology, and then give our core base the flexibility and the power to take advantage of all the goodness of VS. Mm-hmm. To also participate in this polyglot world and be able to take advantage of all the great technologies out there as well and still maintain not only the power and the openness, but also the productivity that I think people have come to expect and the polish that people have come to expect with our development offerings, that we can take all this tech that can sometimes be overwhelming,
right,
make it easy, make you successful, and enable you to kind of build things faster and better than ever before.
Awesome. So as a reminder, please make sure to ask some questions of Scott Guthrie, because I'm just going to hog him all to myself if you don't. So let's start with a question that I've been wondering about. Developers before used to be sort of like this, we're in Visual Studio and that's it. But it feels like developers now have to have sort of a broader understanding of things. How is Microsoft helping them with sort of that knowledge as well as the tools to sort of expand into DevOps, into hosting, into doing other things?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think developers have always had to have awareness around practices, techniques, APIs, technologies. I mean, so from you know, one perspective, I think that's something that developers have always had to do in some way, shape, or form. And you know, I think one of the things that we try to do with our Visual Studio tools has been make it easy. You know, it's IntelliSense is one of those things that, you know, no one likes to admit that they really like until you actually try developing without it.
It's my crush.
And it's like, wow, this is just much, much easier and makes me more productive. You know, refactoring support, debuggers, you know, a bunch of these tools that we've taken for granted probably for the last 10 or 15 years, you know, have really made us successful. You know, a lot of the techniques and features that we've added over the last couple years with things like our Visual Studio Online, or now called Team Services, mm-hmm, offerings, things like the App Insights that let you do crash analytics and real-time usage data, and you know, a lot of the DevOps features that we've introduced in the last year or two, you know, are also kind of making it much easier to kind of fall into what I call the pit of success, mm-hmm, where it doesn't mean you have to use the tool, it doesn't have to mean it's IDE driven, but if you can, you know, provide a good set of capability and have a streamlined experience that helps you fall into good best practices, you know, I think that makes people much more successful. I think one of the big changes we've done philosophically the last 2 years is be able to say, you know, in the past, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, you know, all that worked nicely if you only used our frameworks,
right,
or you did it our way and or built apps for our platform. And what we're trying to do, and I think did a good job showing today, is now you can actually have that same productive experience, but you can use Docker and Mesos and Swarm and containers. You can use Android and iOS, and you can actually, you know, enable integrated DevOps into you know, an app store that's not ours, you can, you know, basically use our build server, you know, not only with our CI frameworks, but with Jenkins and others. You can use our testing framework, or you can use 25 other different testing frameworks. And, you know, that flexibility and the ability to kind of use anything that's cool in the broader developer community, but still maintain that productivity, you know, I think that's special. It gives people more options, right, more flexibility, but it's still at the same time gives them that streamlined experience that can make them incredibly successful.
You've talked a lot about sort of this flexibility. Let's move to the openness. I mean, we're not just talking about using open source and supporting open source. We're also talking about open sourcing some of the stuff that we built. And not just like, I can see the source, but it's literally open source. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, we've started this journey. I mean, it's going back a couple years now, you know, when we open sourced .NET or ASP.NET, and then some EF, and then we, you know, added last this event last year, we open sourced .NET.
Right.
And Roslyn and the C# compilers. And, you know, we've kind of, you know, steadily been going down this path, partly because we're learning from it. And then also, we're, you know, we want to make sure we don't freak people out into thinking, oh, you know, what's going on? And I think we've done a good job of both showing when we open source things, we're not abandoning things. We're in many ways injecting new energy into those things and providing even more flexibility as we do it. And, you know, today we took two big steps. One was releasing the release candidates of ASP.NET 5 as well as the .NET Core, you know, simultaneously, not just on Windows, but also on Linux and Mac, and provided a go-live license for all of them. It's open source, so you don't technically need a license anyway, but, you know, that we're basically saying we think from a stress and performance perspective now, it's ready to run production applications. And then probably even a bigger step in some ways was open sourcing our Visual Studio Code tool that we released 6 months ago, and that is the full tool, so the editor, the debugger, the extensibility model, pretty much everything. And that's a big, significant chunk of code. And, you know, the great thing, and we also released our new extensibility APIs as part of that. And so the great thing now is we're already seeing lots of developer communities building extensions into VS Code because it runs on Windows, Mac, and Linux.
Right.
It means any developer can use it. And, you know, we're even seeing big companies. You know, we saw Google on stage talking about how they're using VS Code internally to build Angular and to build some of their other things. You know, I think you'll see other big companies as well that are already starting to use it, you know, start to talk about how they're extending it as well. And, you know, we're pretty excited because it brings the VS family to a much broader set of developers. And then more importantly, it gets a much broader set of developers adding value to the VS family that can be shared across everyone using it. And so, you know, I think it's a real win-win for everyone. And, you know, it's sort of indicative of the type of openness we're really trying to drive.
That's awesome. So let's move over to Azure data centers. Boris S. says, is there a question, is there a definitive date for when there can be Azure data center in Canada?
Yeah, so one of the things we announced earlier this year was we're adding two Azure regions to Canada. We're the first hyperscale cloud vendor that'll be operating in Canada. We also last week announced UK and German-based regions as well, and then I was just in India 2 weeks ago where we were talking about the three new India regions. So we have lots of regions opening up around the world. I don't know if we've announced a definitive date for when the Canada regions are opening. It will be in calendar year 2016, we're working hard as fast as possible. So, you know, it's not too far off.
Right.
All the features that are available in the rest of our North America regions will obviously be available in Canada as well. So the thing I'd recommend is, you know, you can always start developing today using, say, the Chicago region, which is very close to Canada. And then the beauty is, you know, you can just redeploy your application to the Canada regions once they're open.
That's awesome. Next question from Phil. .NET Core go live on Linux. What kind of apps are using .NET Core today? Do you know of any?
Yeah, there's a number of people that are starting to use .NET Core. And, you know, we've been hesitant about pushing it in a big way on
right.
Linux until we felt like the stress and reliability and performance were there. You know, Scott Hanselman was just saying, or Scott Hunter was just telling me, I think last night, you know, in our perf tests now, pretty much our Windows and Linux version is basically within about 2% of each other in terms of perf. So, you know, that's a big step up from where we were a couple months ago when we were first getting it off the ground. You know, I think, you know, a couple of the customers that are publicly talking about at this event include Verizon, that have actually deployed a bunch of applications on Linux.
Wow.
.NET applications on Linux, and a whole bunch more that are taking advantage of it. And that, you know, the beauty is, you know, it's a very flexible, powerful framework. And so I think you'll see quite a bit more applications being built and used on it, probably in a few weeks from now.
Right.
Now that the bits are out there. And you know, we're pretty excited to see what people do with it. One of the demos that also Scott Hanselman showed in my keynote this morning, that's kind of an early precursor, but we're also pretty excited about, is native compilation for
right.
.NET, which we support today for .NET apps that are universal Windows apps that are deployed through the store. And we showed, and we're enabling it both for Windows Server apps or as well as for Linux apps with .NET Core. And what that basically means is, you know, when you have an app that you know, uses a bunch of C#, a bunch of .NET code, it actually does static compilation of the app when you run this option and generates a pure 100% native XE. And that means you don't have 25 DLLs. You literally have one binary file. You know, he was demoing, you know, a simple Hello World console app, and it's, you know, it ends up being a 1.7 megabyte XE because it's statically linking in all the runtime libraries. But once you have that, you can then just copy it onto any machine without having to install the .NET runtime, without having to install the .NET framework. It literally is just an XE. And beyond just having kind of a simple deployment model of one binary, it also has the benefit of much, much faster startup time because there's no jitting involved and much lower working set. And you know, we're pretty excited about that, in that it really enables, you know, a lot of people are, on other platforms have been excited about Go because it has a similar characteristic. You know, we think now this really enables you to use .NET and C# and have the same characteristic with an even richer surface area and developer experience.
And we're talking binaries on both Windows and Linux?
Yeah. So the demo we showed that Scott Hanselman did was actually doing native compilation on a Mac, or actually on Linux, on an Ubuntu image. And, you know, again, basically building it. It's still early days. You know, that is not production ready yet. But, you know, I think that's an exciting thing that as it comes to market, you'll see a whole bunch of pretty high scale internet properties look at, because it's a pretty big differentiator for them.
Awesome. All right. So Al says, things have been very quiet around Service Fabric. When will you share more information about Service Fabric? What is Service Fabric? And then maybe some more information.
Yeah. Well, so today we shared a bunch of information. If you watch Scott Hanselman's breakout talk that he just finished, he does actually a really nice set of Service Fabric demos. It's a really great talk. And so I definitely recommend that. And one of the things we announced today was our new Azure Service Fabric service, which allows you to use the Service Fabric framework and easily deploy and manage it inside Azure and use Visual Studio to develop against it. And you know, for people that don't know what Service Fabric is, it's a really great framework that enables you to build very high-scale microservice-based architectures, including stateful ones. So, you know, there's lots of different ways to build stateless microservices. But if you want to manage state or caching and you want to be able to roll, say, code updates out across thousands of machines or even just dozens of virtual machines with zero downtime, that's a hard problem. And anyone in the cloud business knows that's a hard set of challenges. And Service Fabric gives you the programming framework as well as the runtime technology in order to do that. You know, a lot of our internal systems like SQL databases, you know, Skype, and a whole bunch more of the core Azure system is built using Service Fabric. So it's very much a framework that we extracted from our own runtime production systems. And the beauty is it's now available for you to download, start using, and be able to deploy and scale it out in a high scale way inside Azure. So definitely watch Scott Hanselman's talk because he's got a very nice demo that I think talks to some of the benefits about it. And then we've got some great documentation and, you know, now some really good Visual Studio tooling that helps enable it as well.
Awesome. So sometimes it feels like there's a fire hose of just goodness coming from Microsoft. Kenneth says, what is the best way to start learning and using the tools? platforms and services Microsoft offers?
Well, there's a couple ways, Kenneth, that you can take advantage of it. Both in terms of, we have a new Dev Essentials offer that we just announced today.
Yeah.
And that basically has free Visual Studio Community Edition and VS Code, which you can also download separately. But then it also includes $25 a month of free Azure credits. That's coming soon. It's not available today, but it will be soon, that you can use to build anything you want, not have to pay anything on Azure. And then it also includes a bunch of training, including both from us as well as from folks like Pluralsight and Wintellect and Xamarin on, you know, how to build apps. And there's some really good courses that they all have. And so that's a program that you can definitely take advantage of. And then the other thing that we have now is obviously BizSpark, which is a great program for startups. Dev Essentials is for everyone in the world. BizSpark is great for startups. You do have to be a startup to be in the program, but that gives you even more tooling and gives you even richer Azure credits. If you're an incubator, I think it's up to $120,000 a year of Azure usage, which is quite a bit.
Yeah.
And is, you know, really perfect and ideal for people that have an idea, create a company, and really want to go build the dream.
I mean, if you don't have a sense for like how much $25 is, you could probably run a couple of Azure websites with that and still be under the cap.
Yeah, you can even run, I mean, I think if you run a virtual, an extra small virtual machine, I think that's $12 or $14 a month. And then an Azure website, you know, starts with free, but, you know, if you buy like an SSL cert in a shared account, I think it's $8 a month. So yeah, you can do a lot with $25 a month. A database, I think, starts at $5 a month. So yeah, with $25 a month, you can easily have a VM, a web app, with SSL and a database, and not pay anything at all.
Well, you have some left over, almost.
Yeah, maybe a dollar or two, but you can throw in, you know, some IoT events and a few other things.
Yeah, so your next like really good idea could literally be up with Dev Essentials pretty soon.
Yeah.
All right. So next question: what does the future of classic Azure cloud services look like?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, one of the things to keep in mind is, you know, most, if not all, of our higher level Azure services these days are built using Azure cloud services. So the good news is they're not going away at all, because we actually run our own infrastructure on top of them. We are seeing, though, I mean, the cloud services model that we first came out with is a couple years old now. And, you know, there are a number of enhancements that we've done since then. And so things like Service Fabric, things like our VM scale sets, which we just shipped last week, which enable you to basically take VMs, create your own VM image with anything you want in them, and then basically say blast out 1,000 instances of these, and be able to do patching and manage of them in a really smart way. And things like our Azure Resource Manager. We do think some of these building blocks that we've come out with are things that we've learned from with our cloud services model and tried to basically build into even more modular pieces. And so we do expect, and at some point we'll actually walk people through, you know, if you have a classic cloud service, how would you adopt some of these new capabilities?
Right.
And at the same time, we're going to keep adding features to cloud services as well, since a lot of people, including ourselves, are building apps on top of them. And you know, you'll continue to see us roll out tooling improvements as well as runtime improvements that people can take advantage of that as well.
That's awesome. So it seems like as we've been building Azure, we're like, oh, that's actually really useful. Maybe we should let our customer. Is that a lot of that happening as we build Azure?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing about the cloud space right now, this is true not only for us, but this is true for AWS and others, is, you know, is the cloud world is just evolving so quickly.
Yeah.
And so if it seems like, wow, there's a lot of stuff, it's partly because there is a lot of stuff. And it's also a lot of the things that we're all shipping are based on learnings that we've accrued using real world scenarios. And so as more people do richer and bigger things in the cloud, you know, there's learnings that we get from them. And what we try to do is anytime we see something that's hard or something that people do a lot, how do we extract that learning and either provide a service or a framework that makes it easier for people, you know, to do it
yeah.
themselves.
All right, so we have a question. Scott, when Windows Phone. When will Windows Phone receive the new Windows 10 OS? Like, I chewed on. That's a lot of W's.
I don't actually have to confess. I don't know because that team doesn't work for me. I believe it's coming soon, though. But I don't know if Kevin Gallo is coming on the show later.
Yeah, maybe I'll ask him.
Kevin will definitely know.
Yeah, so we'll hold that one for later. The next one is Microsoft building a data center in South Africa?
We haven't announced anything in South Africa yet.
But it's a big continent. Who knows? Yeah. When will you share more on Azure Stack? First of all, let's explain what Azure Stack is, because it's a really interesting technology. And then when are we going to share more on availability and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that differentiates Azure, and I talked a little bit about this in the keynote, and Scott Hansman did a good job talking about it as well, is, you know, Azure is a hyperscale cloud vendor. And so we've got regions of Azure all over the world. And a region for us is typically multiple data centers, 5, 6, sometimes 10 data centers in the same geographic location. We call that a region. And we make it look like it's one giant data center that you can deploy code to. And we've got 28 announced regions around the world. And that really gives us global coverage in a pretty big way. And we've got lots of great compliance certifications and infrastructure that you can use without having to buy any of your own data centers or stack in order to build apps. But at the same time, we recognize that not everything can run in the public cloud. Not everything is designed for it. Not everything people feel comfortable ready for it. And you know, every large enterprise has their own set of data centers and their own set of existing infrastructure. And you know, we're very different than, say, AWS or others that just say, throw that away and go to the cloud. And in that we say, look, we love on-prem as well. You know, we don't think everything should be turned off tomorrow and moved to the cloud. Mm-hmm. If you do, we've got a great cloud for you. But we recognize it's going to be a journey, and you might not be comfortable just flipping a switch and doing it in one day. And we're delivering something we call Azure Stack, which basically allows you to take the same programming model, the same management API, the same core cloud fabric, and run it on premises. And so with Azure Stack, you can download it and run it on your own servers. We also work with partners like Dell, which we announced a partnership with last month, and you'll see others in the future, where you can take that Azure Stack and you can run it on certified hardware that's already been pre-tested and performance scaled, and run it there. And you can also run it inside service provider or hosting environments as well. And that flexibility where you can build a solution and target one of our regions, or effectively have your own region, you know, Contoso region, in South Africa or anywhere else you want to that we don't have a region yet, that ability to kind of deploy inside Visual Studio and just say, you know, right-click publish or build a continuous integration pipeline that does it, you know, is a really big differentiator for us and a reason we think to use our cloud versus someone else's.
So Azure Stack is essentially getting like a mini Azure in your own data center.
Yeah, and it really enables a unique cloud hybrid story that no one else has. You know, VMware will tell you, hey, use VMware, but they don't have a hyperscale cloud. Amazon doesn't run any software outside of their own data centers. That same is true for both IBM and Google and elsewhere, is they've got one or the other, but they don't have both. We're really the only vendor out there that has both hyperscale cloud and enables private cloud on-prem in any way.
That's awesome. All right. So next question, any plans for GPU-based massive parallelism on Azure services? I remember hearing something about this.
Yeah, so we've done a couple announcements. On GPU specifically, one of the things that we announced last month at our AzureCon was something called the N-series of virtual machines. Blank there on the name for a second. Basically, the N-series is GPU enabled. And so you can now, you know, you'll be able to, it's currently in preview, but you'll basically be able to use those to run any GPU-based workloads in Azure. And they use the latest NVIDIA GPU processors. And so that's something we have announced recently. And then the other thing that we've done that we're seeing a lot of success with is launched a service we call our Azure Batch Service. And the batch service allows you to run massively parallel jobs inside Azure. It doesn't today have the GPU option. That'll come in the future. But for anything that doesn't require a GPU, and especially things that can be massively parallelized, the batch service provides a really great way that you can effectively give a job to us, and you can spin up tens of thousands of virtual machines effectively to run it, and not have to do a lot of the administrative trivia in terms of managing it. And things like video encoding are done with it. We've got people that are doing, you know, Monte Carlo simulations for financial institutions, engineering stress jobs, graphics rendering, you know, some of the Pixar movies. If you watch Pixar movies from Disney, have rendered using that framework on Azure.
Wow.
So there's lots of use cases there that you can take advantage of.
Well, that's awesome. A couple more questions. Any updates as to when we'll take the preview moniker off of the new Azure portal, or Ibiza, as we call it?
Yes, very, very, very soon. we are days or weeks away from finally calling the Azure preview, you know, preview portal the Azure portal. We've tried to be very usability and data driven on it. I mean, it's the portal's been out for about 18 months now in preview form, which feels like a long time, but there's a lot of features now inside Azure, and so we've had the fun challenge of both keeping the old portal up to date while we finish the new portal. And the thing that we try to do is be very data driven and, you know, really look hard at reliability, performance, and then usability. And you know, we didn't feel like we were at that point where we were green on all those different metrics. And so the thing we said is, hey, let's get green on them. And you know, every week we have a great report, or every day, but I see it every week. You know, what is the reliability of every extension in the portal? You know, we basically said, you know, we want an average load time of less than 2 seconds for every extension in the portal. And at the 95th percentile, every extension's got to load within 8 seconds.
Right.
Because if you don't do that, then it won't feel as snappy as you'd like. And, you know, we're now at the point where all of our core extensions meet that criteria. And then the other thing we did was we said, you know, we're going to basically do usability studies to both measure success of tasks as well as people's perception of the tasks. Or experience, you know, how do we measure those every week on every extension? We got to get green on our sus score for that. And the great thing is the team's done a fantastic job the last couple of months, you know, doing kind of pretty much weekly updates, and we're pretty much green across all of them. And so, yeah, you'll see us go GA on that very, very soon. I feel super proud about what the team's done there.
Awesome. Well, we got a couple more questions, and we're going to rifle through them. What's the difference between Orleans and Service Fabric? Why have two seemingly very similar distributed actor models?
Yeah, good question. Orleans was a project that we came out with originally from actually our research group that pioneered some really good kind of actor-based programming model. And I've seen a lot of success and popularity. I think a lot of the Halo services were built on it. Service Fabric came from a different group, and in particular at a lot of the stateful compute capabilities had a whole bunch of capabilities and I'd say a lot of lower level plumbing in particular that enabled you to build super high scale complex services. And one of the things that we've tried to do is add an actor-based programming framework into Service Fabric.
Right.
So that we could take a lot of the learnings from Orleans and enable that within Service Fabric. We'll continue to support, and you know, Orleans is open source, and it is a framework that we have a lot of support for. But we tried to sort of add a lot of the goodness of Orleans into Service Fabric, which brought with it a whole bunch of really robust distributed systems capability, and have also kind of a union of the two, which we're calling Service Fabric.
Awesome. Two quick fire questions. Will Azure support development workstations hosted in Azure?
Yes, we do actually today now support having a Windows client VM running inside Azure. And so, yeah, you can actually create, you know, either a Windows Server image, or you can definitely create also now a Windows client image. And if you're an MSDN customer, we actually have a pre-built, I think it's a Windows 10 MSDN image already created that you can basically go ahead and easily deploy.
So as we're wrapping up, final statements, what do you want developers to know? Why are we excited about Azure and all the stuff we're doing for developers?
Well, I mean, I think in general, it's an exciting, it's, you know, one of the things I said in the keynote is it's never been a better time to be a developer. And I really do believe that, you know, both in terms of all the coolness of stuff you can do, but also just the role that developers play in enabling organizations to kind of compete in this digital world. As more things go digital, you know, the percentage of impact that a developer can have on a company is enormous. And, you know, I think it's an exciting time. You know, and the thing that we've been focused on, and I think it made a lot of progress, and hopefully today is a good example of it, is just, you know, how do we enable developers to do more and achieve more and, you know, be able to kind of build these next generation applications, be able to use every technology out there, whether it's built by us or by others, and be immediately productive with it, and really have the kind of experience and the joy that a really great set of tools can give you to be successful. And I think of those tools both as Visual Studio family, whether it's the VS IDE, VS Code, or Visual Studio Team Services. And then, you know, in particular in a cloud environment, providing the capability to run all that stuff everywhere over the world.
Sounds like a bunch of fun, really cool stuff.
Hopefully it's fun times.
All right, well, thanks for spending some time with us, my friend. We have Dan over there with a really cool guest. I think you're going to like it.